This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week, number 693, brought to you by the new Audible original Stan Lee's Alliances, A Trick of Light, and iFanboy listeners just like you. Welcome to iFanboy Pick of the Week. This is episode 693. I'm Josh Flanagan. This is my co-host, at least in body, if not fully in spirit, Connor Kilpatrick.
Did you mess up your own last name?
Did I?
I feel like you said Flanagan.
I mean, I might have rushed it. Listen, as long as it's spelled right, I don't really care.
Drunk on a Friday morning.
I have an iced coffee. That's as close as it comes.
So I'm Connor. That's Josh. We take no responsibility for this episode because, number one, Josh is baking in the Northeast. He just turned his air conditioning off. Number two, I'm still on the road. Last week I was in San Diego. This week I'm on the East Coast. I literally was on a red-eye flight an hour ago. I haven't slept in 24 hours because I don't sleep on planes, and I'm really tired. So
I mean, like at a certain point, It was at least a few years ago. I go, oh, I just can't do red eye flights anymore. That's not an option because of the pain.
Sure.
And you are holding on, I guess.
Well, it's convenient for work.
Sure. Sure.
To leave after work and that sort of thing. It's also let's talk about this off the show.
You know what? I think this is what the people come for. At least the stalwarts, the people who've been hanging around for 690 plus episodes are like, no, that's what we want. Screw the comics. We're iFanboy. We don't screw the comics. Every week we talk about our stack of comics. One of us picks their favorite book. We call that the pick of the week. We talk about that book, other books from the week, the patron book. The patron book. That's we're gonna rebrand it. The book. That's Yiddish. Mishpuka. We will talk about the patron pick, which is not the patron book, but who knows? Maybe if we have time, we'll read some listener mail. We'll see how it goes. It should be a fun old time. I'm pretty excited to watch Connor disintegrate. And it's not hot in here yet, but over the course of this, it will get hotter and hotter and hotter, almost imperceptibly. And that's when it will get fun.
That's the diabolical nature of it, is that you don't really notice it until it's too late.
Yep. Your spoiler warning is this, that this is a review show. In instances where it is necessary, we'll have to talk about what happens in those books. So if you have not read them, that's your own call to go forward with this. That's how we're saying. Connor, you had the pick, which was surprising because once again, I was like, well, you're like, hey, look, he made the pick. Oh, it's not. I did it last week. I don't even know anymore.
Yeah. Also, I'm recording on my iPad. So just that's FYI for all you audiophiles who notice any perceptible decrease in audio quality and then complain to us about it. I had the pick.
Is that a thing? And
yeah, sometimes. And I actually was a hard choice somewhat because this was a pretty strong week of comics from my point of view. I had like four or five books I could have made a case for, and I had a couple that I was really sort of waffling about. And I slept on it. I could have made the pick Wednesday, but I slept on it to Thursday.
And then you made that up by not sleeping at all.
That's right. The pick ended up being Marvel's Epilogue, story by Kurt Busiek, art by Alex Ross, letters by John Rochelle and Richard Starkings. And this is as the title says, the epilogue to Marvel's, which is the groundbreaking miniseries in the early 90s from Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross that took a street-level look at the creation of the Marvel Universe and really introduced Alex Ross to the comic book world, and love him or hate him, he really blew everyone's minds at that time. And then he went on to do Kingdom Come, and he went on to do Justice, and then there was a sequel miniseries, Eye of the Camera, which I don't believe Alex Ross painted. I believe Kurt Busiek wrote it, but it was a different painted artist who painted it.
I don't remember. I read the back matter, and not all of it, but I read some of it, and they had mentioned that, and I kind of forgot about it.
I'm fairly certain Alex Ross didn't do that one, but I could be wrong. Either way, you know, we haven't seen these two guys together in a long time. And I didn't know this was coming out. So
no, yeah, it really seemed like – I thought it was Marvel will do fairly regular, like, repackagings of things.
Right.
And I thought – and they've been doing a lot of, like, reprinting of the first issue of something important and then sort of putting a pack – and I thought this was that. I didn't notice what it actually was. And then the only other, I just want to put this in people's heads for context, which I think was the most interesting thing, is that when I was reading the back matter, they said that Alex Ross was 24 when he did the first one. And I went, oh my God, I just think of him as being this one age.
Forever 50.
Yeah. Or
45 or whatever.
Something like that.
49.
You know, he was unfortunately, I think he went bald a little early. So like it sort of stuck him there.
Well, I met them both. The year this came out, the original issues came out, it was the return of New York Comic Con.
Yeah.
Not the show now. It was the year, you know, an earlier iteration of it. And then it went away for like 20 years. But they were signing, and I got my issues signed.
Nice.
Kurt Busiek did, it was the old, you know, Kurt Busiek did the sketch, and Alex Ross did the water balloon on the on the signing. But yeah, well, I remember him seeming young. But then again, I was a teenager, so
I was shocked that, A, that was 25 years ago. I mean, it makes sense now that I think about it, but I don't think of it like that. And then I was shocked that he was so young to do a thing like that, sort of out of nowhere. And that really, that impressed me. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, no, so this is, as mentioned in that back matter, this is sort of serving two masters. One, it's the anniversary of the book itself, and they're going to be releasing a deluxe hardcover at the end of the year that includes all the original issues, plus this issue, plus... They've been putting out annotated issues, which I have been reading because I've been saving to read it in the hardcover. But that should be interesting too. And so this is the anniversary of that. But Marvel's, it's also Marvel's 80th anniversary. So they've been doing that 80th. That's not right. That's DC. Is it 80?
Yeah.
So they've been doing those special issues. We had that Peter David Hulk, and we had that kind. You know, like, so this is sort of serving both of those masters as like an anniversary issue for the company and an anniversary issue for the series itself. But there's a story here. There's not just a long interview with Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross, which I actually really enjoyed. I read the whole thing. There's a 16-page story here, and some people were grumbling online about it. This is the length of it. The fact of the matter is, it's a very labor-intensive book. And
I mean, I'm shocked that there were 16 pages. Like Alex Ross literally goes, "I was kind of hoping to be 8," and I was like, "Well, no shit, Alex. You made your bed."
it's only a handful of pages less than a regular comic, so it's not like I didn't feel cheated out
of it. It's four spreads less than a regular comic.
Yeah, so what was cool about this issue was the original miniseries took place in the, you know, the Kirby 60s, and the X-Men were there, but they weren't really a main part of it because they had one issue about the X-Men, but they weren't, you know, the main thread was mostly the Avengers and Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, because those were the main heroes for Marvel back then. So here we spend a little time with the new X-Men team, the post original team. And what was cool about it was they took an issue, and this is such a Kurt Busiek thing to do, is he took an issue that was set in the right place, that featured the right characters, that even had a guy in the background that looked kind of like the main character in Marvel's, and they set this story in between the pages of that issue, even recreating one of the pages from it. And, you know, to me, Marvel's is... It's certainly one of my favorite books of all time, and to me, it might be the most the best thing Marvel's ever put out. And so to come back to the world, and Alex Ross is a better painter now, to come back to the world and feel right at home again, it was like a warm blanket. You know, every one of these pages made me happy. The little Easter eggs in the background, the characters, you know, searching the crowd for Kurt Busiek or famous faces, and Clark Kent's in there as played by Christopher Reeve, and old New York too. Even though that takes place at Rockefeller Center at Christmas, and that's where my dad worked. I can see his office building. We used to go to that movie theater, the Guild 50th, which is now a Anthropology. In this book, it's playing King Kong, but we used to go to that theater all the time after my dad got off of work, and I even worked during the summertime. So that was fun for me. And then just sort of getting a brief moment with these X-Men characters. And then there's a funny Nova joke in the middle, which is he arrives, basically his first appearance, and no one knows who he is. And everyone's like, who the fuck is this guy? It was like a warm Marvel blanket. And I know this isn't necessarily everyone's cup of tea, but to me, the intelligence and the humanity that Kurt Busiek brings to the story is matched by the, I still think, startling work from Alex Ross. So that's why Marvels is one of my all-time favorite books, and that's why this issue was picked, because even this brief issue in which the X-Men are at Rockefeller Center, and so is, what's his name? The photographer.
Phil Sheldon?
Phil Sheldon's there with his daughters, who are now grown up from the original series, and there's a fight with the Sentinels, and so the X-Men reveal themselves, and the daughters love Storm, and they're also photographers, and there's a lot of fun things going on here. And, he gets to have a little adventure with his daughters, and they get to experience what it was like for him in the original series to be covering from the ground these superheroes, feeling at once excited but also sort of scared and helpless at the same time. It was great, and there's a great two-page spread here where he sort of remembers some of the highlights from the original series and, gets to walk off into the snow set with his daughters. I imagine this is probably the end for them, like in terms of doing Marvel stories.
They joked
about doing, again, when they're in their 80s in 25 more years, but it's a nice capper. And I think when you take it all together, it'll be a nice little epilogue. It sort of feels like that epilogue that they did for Kingdom Come, they put out with the trade paperback, if you recall, with Bruce and Clark and Diana having lunch together. It felt kind of like that kind of thing.
Oh, right. Yeah. And,
I love this issue.
I was unsurprised that you made this your pick of the week. I know that this has always been a thing for you. Mm-hmm. That you've really loved. I missed it a little bit. Like, this came along right before I think I started reading comics again. When I was getting back in.
Sure. Yeah, it was a few years before you jumped.
Kingdom Come was the thing. Yeah. And I've gone back and forth on Alex Ross. I 100% recognize. 100,000% recognize that what he's doing is really impressive. And that it takes a lot of work, and it is very special. I don't like it as a style so much. Like, I can read it and be like, oh, that's very good. It's like listening to Rush. Like, wow, right. That's impressive what they're doing. I don't love it. You know, like, 16 pages was great for me. Because I could, wow, that's really amazing. I think, for me, when you bring it into that realistic space, it loses a little bit of its, and it's all the point. I totally, like, I'm not saying it shouldn't be. It's just not my favorite thing. However, the other side of it is that, like, I would be hard to think of a writer from Busiek's generation who is better than him.
Yeah, and that's the other part of it. I think it's a pleasure. It's an increasingly rare pleasure to get a Busiek story, and one that really works. Also, he's on page 11. I just found him.
Yeah,
with his little hat and a white goatee.
Well, what I think is, I don't understand why he's still not working a lot. Really, you know what I mean? Because he's so he's not any worse than he ever was. You know, and he doesn't come across as old. He's certainly reverent of a time, but not to the point of like fan service to himself or to Marvel. Like, he's still like a complete package. And the other thing that he has is he's incredibly sincere. Like, he's one of the most sincere writers out there. Like, he can do things that are emotional and romantic and have that fuzzy, glossy edge to them. And it doesn't suck. You know, it's a rare thing to be able to do that, I think. And you know, maybe that has to do with sort of the era that we came up in comics, but just a ton of talent. And, you know, everything he touches has something valuable to it.
I mean, he is doing those Astro City graphic novels now. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much of that's taking up all this time, but it's kind of crazy that in a world of double shipping comics and just fire hosing totally. Books down our throats, that there's no Marvel book for Kurt Busiek out there. You know, there's no Avengers comic.
I look back at his Avengers run and Avengers Forever. I'm like, those are great books. If Dan Slott can get work, why can't Kurt Busiek?
I mean, I think you're gonna look back, and he's gonna be one of those important writers of the modern era.
I think he's got a real Roy Thomas of the '90s thing.
Yes.
I mean, if you think about it, this is a guy who hung on and made memorable stories at a time when Marvel was at its lowest point ever. Mm-hmm. You know, Marvel was in bankruptcy. You know, but those Avengers, Thunderbolts, all that stuff before, in the Bob Harris days, basically, before Joe Quesada came over. And I don't know what the deal is with that. Why?
But I'd go one further and say that, you know, people who came along the last 10 years or so may not understand that before the movies, the Avengers were the second class team.
Yeah.
And so to come along and revitalize the Avengers with George Perez and make it a big time book was a big deal, because it was it was the second banana to the X-Men for like 30 years.
Yeah, and because he's kind of
came along and changed the whole dynamic.
He's kind of a classic guy, I think he doesn't get the credit he deserves. You know, because Grant Morrison came and he reinvented everything. But
right.
Grant Morrison was just doing a postmodern version of the Silver Age stuff that Kurt Busiek could do in his sleep. And if you look at, you know, the other guy from that era who I think is, you know, super impressive is Mark Waid. And as I have grown older and become, like, I think I resonate more with Kurt Busiek stuff than Mark Waid's. There's something more classic and timeless about it, I guess. Which isn't a knock against Waid at all.
I feel like an idiot, like a lot of the time, but right now specifically because I don't think I ever really put together that Alex Ross doing all of the covers for Astro City was just them continuing their partnership for Marvels.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
There was so much separation from those books that I just sort of forgot. Like, oh right, he's working with Alex. They became stars together.
Yeah, they made each other's careers.
And so they stayed a team this whole time. So that's why when you read the interview in the back end, so you have the 16-page story, but you also have a really long interview with the two of them.
And other people.
You can tell they're friends. At least they're friendly.
Yeah.
At least they have a good rapport.
Or they can act like it on camera. Like whatever.
And they've been working together basically nonstop for the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I realized that, even though I do realize that. And my conscious brain didn't really put it together.
Sure.
But, right, these guys have been doing this comics together in some form or fashion since the early 90s.
It also deserves, so there's a little like Mad Magazine cracked sort of thing right after the story that is delightful. It is 1,000% a faithful reproduction of what you would have read in one of those magazines.
Yeah.
It's, you know, every name has been slightly changed. There's innuendos, there's goofy jokes, you know, the things that there's no place for in this world anymore, which is why Mad Magazine is where it is. But as a sort of momentary throwback to a different time, I was like, oh, that was lovely.
I love that they're talking about when, I guess Alex has done some covers that I haven't seen, but he had to do one for Hawkeye, and Kurt picked a scene where Hawkeye's surrounded by showgirls. And they showed the original page, the Kirby page, and then the Alex Ross version. That's a great image for Hawkeye.
I'm looking for it.
It's on page 20 of your digital reader at the top.
Okay.
Well, Josh looks for that. I mean, there's a lot here. It's a tribute to
that is great.
Marvels. It's a tribute to the Marvel Universe. There's a little explainer about why they picked the issue. There's a recreation of or a reprint of the page that they use, the Dave Cockrum drawn X-Men 84. Uncanny X-Men 84. There's a reason they talk about how they picked Nova as the hero to show up at the end. There's just a lot of good stuff here. I mean, there's a whole bunch of back matter.
You know,
great look at his process too, from the thumbnail to sketch to finished work.
Did you notice that the guy who is the model for Phil Sheldon also did the art on the Mad Magazine bit?
I did not notice that.
Mark Braun drew that and is the Phil Sheldon or Shil Felden in the other version.
Interesting.
One thing I also noticed is looking through the art, Alex Ross is not a, like, his thumbnails look great. You could give those thumbnails to an inker and a colorist, and you'd have a fine looking comic book.
He's a tight thumb. He's a legit artist.
Yes.
The people who make comics are not legit artists, but he is a legit artist. I mean, those are tight thumbnails.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, like, I would be really interesting to see some of this work done in the more traditional style. Like, he mm-hmm. just does the pencils and then has a team go in and, you know, ink and color, you know. Like, I just like to see that. I don't know that it would necessarily be the greatest thing, but I think it would be really interesting to see.
Yeah.
And also make it go a lot quicker.
So I really love Marvel's Epilogue. And if you're a fan of that stuff, it's a must read, I think. If you're a Marvel's fan, it's a must read. Mm-hmm. Or wait till the trade. I mean, honestly, wait till the hardcover comes out. If you don't want to pick up the issue, I seem to not own a collection of Marvel, so I'm just gonna get that hardcover when it comes out. Well, I have the issues forever, and then I get rid of them with all my comics.
You know what you can say about Alex Ross, by the way? That dude has never phoned in a line. No. I mean, like, everything is. If you get it, it's gonna be the full deal, and that's impressive.
Yeah. So now, I think no matter what would have happened, it would have ended up paining Josh in some way, because the runner-up for Pick of the Week was History of the Marvel Universe, number one, from Mark Waid and Javier Rodriguez, which is also that we had a tie for Patreon Pick this week, and as we talked about last time we had a tie, we were not going to do two Patreon books anymore, so we flipped a coin. Tails was House of X, Tails was what the coin came up, so History of Marvel Universe lost the Patreon Pick vote. Anyway, way back in the late 80s, after Crisis on Infinite Earths came out, DC did a two-part prestige miniseries called History of the DC Universe that Marv Wolfman and George Perez did.
Wow.
That basically reset his continuity. It was basically a way to show everyone this is now the official continuity. So it just went through everything, just like this issue did, starting at the primordial ooze, basically, and going through to the present. And I loved that as a kid. I read it over and over again. That's kind of how I memorized DC history and that kind of thing. So if this had come out at the same time, I probably would have had the same depth of knowledge of the Marvel Universe. But here we have a miniseries of unknown length written by Mark Waid with art by Javier Rodriguez that opens up with the last two beings alive in the universe, Franklin Richards and Galactus. Franklin Richards, I guess, is... I knew he was powerful. I guess I didn't realize he was basically immortal. To a level that even other immortals are not immortal.
He can create universes and stuff, I think. That's like his whole deal. Apparently, he's also a mutant. And also, according to, spoiler, House of X, he's apparently also got the nickname Powerhouse. They need to lose that.
Yeah, real quick. So here, Franklin and Galactus, the universe is about to end. They're about to reach the end of the universe, and Galactus will not survive it. Franklin will survive to the next universe. And Franklin's having trouble remembering the history of the universe, so he has Galactus tell him a story of the Marvel Universe. And that's the conceit of starting literally with the Big Bang and the creation of the Celestials and the Eternity and Order and Chaos and the Living Tribune, all those people. It goes up into almost the present day. I loved it. I mean, this is right up my alley. I loved every bit of this. And I didn't know a lot of it, which was fun. But, like, just sort of a anthropological, sociological step-by-step of the Marvel Universe was interesting to me because I don't know a lot of the stuff. And I didn't know, for instance, that Thor's mother was not whoever Odin's wife is, but
Freya.
Gaia, the Earth Mother.
I've never heard that before. I believe this, and I'm guessing that I'd be surprised if like Jason Aaron, like, really, no shit.
well, he has, you know, in the best Mark Waid tradition, there's annotations in the back. Well, I looked it up, and
yeah.
Silver Surfer number 2, number 1989, is when they said Gaia was his mother.
Not a good period for that. Anyway, I really liked this. I had fun reading it. I mean, like, if it had been 64 pages, I'd have been like, okay, that's enough. But really, you know, it comes down to, I was a Marvel kid.
Yeah.
And this brought together a lot of threads. It wasn't really anything here that was shockingly new. I mean, I don't, you know, who remembers all these details?
Sure. Kang Mark Waid does.
Kang was in it in his multiple incarnations, which is great. Or Ramatut, or Immortus. However you want to call him, Kang is Kang. For right. He is Kang. And, you know, it was impressive. Like part of it was the craft of being like, wow. Again, I just said this about Alex Ross, but Mark Waid didn't phone anything in here. And the fact that the annotations are there, and even I didn't necessarily read them all straight through, you know, it was great to see them. Yeah. And, like, everything gets backed up, and you sort of... You know, like the idea of just organizing all this information into something, and there were some things that were from long ago, and then there were some that were not. They get to the part where, you know, they talk about the first Avengers, from the beginning of Jason Aaron's Avengers run. I think I was like, well, let's not put that in here yet. You know, but that's the case. And
it's part of the new continuity. That's what this is.
No, I know.
Setting up sort of the Marvel universe again.
But you know, it didn't hurt that it's Javier Rodriguez. You know, really doing really great work. I loved the style for the first couple pages of the bookends, you know, where it's very graphic and just sort of very basic. And there was other bits in here, you know, there's the page where the Celestials show up. I guess it's the second page of the sort of story, you know, and the Celestial is up in the right-hand corner. He's sort of leaning over and his knees is towards us. There's a ton of Kirby in there, but also a really modern twist on top of it. You know, and if you like all this stuff, you can kind of, you can read it, you can kind of skim through it, you can, you know, you focus on the, oh right, I forgot about Eon, you know, old Quasar books I used to read, you know, and it just sort of, you know, puts everything in place. Bloodstone, right, that was the thing, you know. Here's where Fin Fang Foom comes from. I had no recollection of that. I think that it causes, you know, if you like that thing about Marvel, the Marvel cosmic, you know, and how it all ties in with specifically the Avengers and Fantastic Four, I think are the ones. And those are the things. That's why when I read the same thing for the X-Men, it was kind of interesting, but it didn't really ring any bells for me. I don't think this is good if it's all new to you and you don't really care. Like, oh, I like the Avengers movies. Like, don't read this.
I don't know. I mean, because if you're someone who is wanting to know more about the history of the Marvel Universe, if you're new to comics and you're like, who are these characters? I think this is going to be a very valuable resource.
Yeah, if you're into that kind of thing, I wouldn't be. Like, if I didn't have a history with it, I wouldn't care.
I also think it was fun how it's all weaved through either real history or you know, myth. Like, you know.
Yeah.
The Black Knight being, you know, King Arthur's round table and I'm trying to find other historical references here, but they are in there.
You know, this in the same page, like I didn't realize that Morgan Le Fay was King Arthur's half-sister. And I love that the sense of time was really flexible. You know, like first it's like billions of years ago, and then before I know it, you know, we're at the Old West. Yeah, and I was like, well, that was quick.
Well, not a lot happened.
Well, theoretically speaking, it didn't. You know,
so this issue is actually very much like the first issue that DC ran, where it's like stops right at like you know the craft landing from Krypton and the parents getting murdered. You know, like you get a little bit of the JSA, but mostly it's about like the immortal and being. So it was the second issue that as a kid I loved the most. So as you know, the teaser here for the cover of the next one is Captain America and the Invaders and Iron Fists, and so you know we're gonna get to some meaty stuff next.
You know, it's gorgeous. Page 21 of your digital reader, the cover for the next issue, McNiven, inked by Mark Farmer. That is a thing of timeless beauty.
Because it's not sketchy McNiven-y. It's got the Mark Farmer cleanness to it.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Look at the weight of Captain America. That reminds me of like the best pages of How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. I keep looking at it. It's beautiful.
This is a fun book. So if you're someone who doesn't know a lot about the history of these characters or their worlds, and I've always wanted to know, this is a great resource for you from a Marvel point of view. I think they're just. I mean, I learned a ton, and I've been reading these things for 30 years or more.
It was a good time. Now, before we get to these next two issues, there's something you need to know. I didn't read either of them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
and so you didn't. Well, we talked about you weren't going to read Valkyrie, Jane Foster, number one.
Yeah, I didn't like the. Jason Aaron's name on it, almost got me, and I just thought, you know what? That's fine. So let me know if I made a mistake.
He's probably plotting it, but yeah. Al Ewing is his co-writer who is writing the Immortal Hulk, which everyone seems to super love, and every issue I can't decide if I'm going to drop it or not.
I'm in between those two things.
Kefu on art, who I like, and I really like this. This was the one I read this issue very early on. I was like, oh, that could very easily be the pick of the week. Here we get Jane adjusting to life as Valkyrie versus life as Thor, and it's a little bit different. It's not exactly the same. She has different abilities. She's got a cool weapon that basically adjusts itself to whatever it needs to be. Sometimes it's like an axe kind of thing. Sometimes it's the thing with the ball on a chain that you can whip people with. And it's a story that's similar to what we've read before after other events in which criminals in New York have picked up on the loose technology that was left behind from the War of the Realms and are using that to commit crime. So she's trying to gather it back up. So here she's fighting a bunch of low-rent guys with Silver Ghost, Gold Rush, Green Light, Red Line, and they've got all this really cool weaponry, actually. A crossbow that never misses, and the main one, though, is Valkyrie's sword, Brunhilde's sword, which is always fatal no matter what happens.
Wow.
No matter the stab. So she's trying to get those weapons back. And there's actually the bummer about you not reading it is there's a really cool twist at the end that I think is a big spoiler for people who haven't read it. I'll just say this. The fighting was cool with the low-rent guys. The conceit that she's trying to find all these really powerful mystical weapons is interesting. She's been knocked down to assistant coroner from her job as a doctor because she's always late because she's too busy being a hero.
The old Barry Allen.
And the mystery is that the dude with the sword runs away from the battle. He escapes, but a mystery person takes the sword from him and stabs him in the chest, and he dies. So she gets the body at the coroner's office and realizes what happened and goes up to where the Dead as Guardians hang out, because that's not that big of a deal. They're all at that hall having meat and food, and she goes to hang out with Brunhilde and talk about being a Valkyrie and the weapons. And not only is the sword basically always fatal, but you get to summon the winged horse with it too.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
So she's like, damn it, this shouldn't be on the field. She deals it with Heimdall. Like, there's a lot of fun stuff happening. She realizes as Valkyrie, she has the power to activate the Valkyrie vision, which lets her see over everyone's head how close they are to death, which is kind of creepy.
So they're kind of doing our bit.
Yeah. There's a little black ball with a white skull inside of it, and the bigger the ball over the head, the closer to death they are.
I wouldn't even want to know.
Yeah, and there's a neat little reveal where she looks back at Heimdall. He's got a giant one over his head that's about to eat him, and that's when he gets killed. Again, by someone who I'm not going to say who, but it's the person who has the sword. And when I turned the page, I was like, oh, shit, that's cool. So
it's the Punisher? I don't know.
No, it's not the Punisher. It's not the Punisher. Okay. It's someone even worse who would have the sword. So it's someone who's not a Thor villain. So that was fun about it. So it was like, I thought it was super fun. I think you might want to check it out to see what you think.
All right. Here we go.
Now, not totally surprised you didn't read Batman Curse of the White Knight by Sean Murphy. This is his follow-up to the acclaimed miniseries. The first one whose name I don't even remember. White Knight, Batman White Knight.
Yeah.
I love Batman White Knight, and I love this issue. I love Sean Murphy's art. I think he's, unlike anyone else making comics right now, he does everything really well. He does great surroundings. He does terrific vehicles. He does great technology. I love his bat caves. His character work is spectacular. He does a great Joker. And the story is fun. You know, this is an interesting twist on things with, you know, the first story was about how the Joker had this sort of split personality. He was Jack Napier when he wasn't the Joker, and he was a good guy, and he almost brought down Batman by convincing everyone that Batman was the real villain. Here, he's back to being sort of your traditional Joker, and Batman's at odds with himself because he's getting older, and also maybe he realized maybe he was part of the problem. Maybe Batman didn't really help anything, and Dick Grayson and Barbara Gordon have become vigilante cops. They join the GCPD. And meanwhile, this old military veteran shows up at the hospital. He's dying. And it turns out he's John Paul Valley.
Oh, that's flipping through it. So,
but there's also a tie into the historical world of Gotham, in which Lord Wayne, the first Wayne to settle the area, kills an Arkham descendant, and it looks like next to him is a John Paul Valley descendant. So maybe there's some sort of thing here where, because at the end the Joker gives him a sword and says, this is Gotham City is your rightful home. You should be ruling it. Maybe Wayne snaked Gotham away from the Valley family. Uh-huh. And so there'll be some sort of historical tie-in as well. I just love the way Sean Murphy draws. I mean, he's just such a good artist.
He is. It's good looking. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I didn't love the way the story was written before. Or actually, didn't particularly love the story one way or the other. Like, it was kind of interesting for a while, but then that was about it for me. I was like, oh, that was a fun concept, and then it didn't really.
Yeah, I mean, it's an Elseworlds story. It's a black. This is Black Label, but it's for all intents and purposes, it's an Elseworlds, and it's a fun little sort of future Batman tale. I like it a lot.
Well, I guarantee you, there are no dicks in it.
There are no dicks in it, but there's lots of cursing.
There's a butt.
There's lots of butts.
Yeah.
All John Paul Valleys, but there's a lot of them.
All right, that's fine. That's good.
He's actually. There's this. The first thing you see John Paul Valley, he's sitting on the table at the doctor's office with his legs spread, and he's got a hand covering where his junk would be. Well, yeah. Actually, you know what? There's a shadowy junk on page 18.
Well.
The fifth panel.
Yeah, look at that.
Somebody missed that at DC.
Well, he's really.
Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody missed it at AT&T.
Sean Murphy's really one. He's going to push the boundaries there, I think. I think that's pretty clear.
So I was surprised to find that Skyward 15 was the final issue.
I was too. I did not know that. It's one of those things where the issue certainly ends at a point where there could easily be a next arc. It wrapped up. It did. You know, then I looked back and I was like, yeah, they did wrap up a lot of the things really quite nicely. Or at least neatly. And then at the end, you see, you know, you get a pretty sincere wrap-up sort of essay from Joe Henderson, you know, and apparently he's off working on the treatment for the movie, the script,
yes, or the
like
screenplay,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously that's what he's doing next.
I guess he got enough story out of the comic for the screenplay.
Yeah, he's a TV guy. This doesn't make, you know, that's going to pay the bills a lot more than this is. So I totally understand that. I did like, this is going to be, I liked that because Henderson wasn't a comic guy. It felt a little different than a lot of comics. Now, a lot of the things that were in it would have been sort of cliches of TV structure, but because it was put into this form, it still felt kind of novel. And then on top of it, what you had was Lee Garbett really holding it down in terms of comic book. And guy's a huge talent. And I think it was nice to have him on a book that I was interested in. You know, he's done stuff before that, it looked good. I didn't really want to read it. I thought that this was one of those, like, he had a chance to really, you know, shine and sort of do his thing. And I think he took full advantage of it. And the way that this world was realized, it was a really nice playground for the art to sort of go crazy. And I think the characters were fun. And, you know, it's a lot of work to make a bunch of people who don't have costumes on have lives of their own, you know, with the exception of the mother and the daughter looking basically the same age. Besides that, I did really enjoy it. I really liked, you know, I liked the color. I like the whole concept of this thing, and I think it was really fun. And also think, like, you couldn't, while it was structured like a TV show, you couldn't do this as a TV show and have
no,
it look,
it's too expensive.
Right, yeah, and have it look like anything good, but you know, I'm probably projecting a little bit, but I get the sense of a creator who is, you know, successful in another field, who came along and wrote a comic and kind of really fell into the groove of making a comic book. You know, it's like watching somebody fall in love with that craft, and I love that.
Yeah, I mean, the story was good. I thought it fell apart, but it sort of ended with the clash with the farmers, and I think maybe everything after that felt extraneous.
Maybe, yeah.
because it felt like they were starting a new story arc and then it ended. And it's like, well, you just introduced all these new things. That was a strange way to end the story, but that was a minor quibble. Yeah. So I overall, I'm glad I read it. It was fun. I'm glad you picked whatever happened to it. You made me read it. That's how.
Yeah, and the thing was, my affection for it really isn't so much like that it was a perfect story, because you're right, it wasn't. There was definitely, you know, there was growing pains, but it was fun to read. Like, and it had a. I like the attitude even of this last issue where I don't know anyone's name, but the girl, you know, she's just like king of the world in this one. She's like, nope, not doing that. Doing this. Look, didn't care what anybody else said. You know, you were all wrong before, so do it now. And, you know, there was a lot of work done in this to wrap things up. You know, it's almost like, and then there's a bit where they were setting up like a conflict where her boyfriend looked like, well, he was going to go back to work for the family and then there would be a conflict there. And she's like, nah, that makes sense. Cool. See ya. You know, and it was just kind of sweet, and I really love what it looks like. I think the coloring in this, I think, does a ton with the blue skies and the sort of
the art thing. Was terrific. Yeah, the garbage art is terrific.
It was. So it was. You know, it feels like I'm getting less of these image or just creator owned series that I really like, and this was one, so I was glad to stick through it. And you know, if this is it, didn't overstay its welcome, so good to go.
Support for this episode is brought to you by the new Audible original, Stan Lee's Alliances, A Trick of Light. In one of Stan Lee's final and most innovative works, the legend invites audiences to unleash the power of their own imagination to bring a new universe and a cast of superheroes to life. Performed by Yara Shahidi, star of Grownish and The Sun is Also a Star, one of today's brightest talents, and featuring a captivating introduction from Lee himself, this new superhero origin story takes on the ever-blurring line between humanity and technology, while agitating the central question of our day: what is more real, a world we are born into or one we create ourselves? Both epic and intimate, fascinating and funny, this is essential Stan Lee. Listen free with a 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/ifanboy or text ifanboy to 500-500. Stan Lee's Alliance is A Trick of Light. The power to change changes everything. Explore all the ways listening to Audible can help improve your mind, body, and soul with entertainment, information, and inspiration. Start listening with a 30-day trial today. Get your first audiobook plus two Audible originals for free. That is audible.com/ifanboy or text ifanboy to 500-500.
I'm a subscriber.
Well, you should check it out.
Yeah,
true. Batgirl 37, I wanted to mention very quickly because it's got a new creative team and it's an interesting one. Cecil Castellucci is the new storyteller. And the artist is Carmine DiGiadomenico, who we've seen, and the colorist is Jordi Belair. It's a top-flight creative team.
Yes, it is.
Which is interesting because, with all due respect to the last creative team, they were all solid, solid comic creators, but solid in that right down the middle of the road way. You know what I mean? Like
that DC Comics.
Like I couldn't say a bad thing about it. I couldn't say a good thing about it. It just was down the middle, and it in that sense kind of disappointing because it's, you know, nothing exciting but nothing bad. So it's, you know, it is what it is. Here you've got Cecil Castellucci, who's a really terrific writer who does a lot of different work. I haven't always liked everything she's done, but she's always done interesting work. And then Carmine DiGiadomenico. When's the last time we saw him?
I forgot about that name, but was he on Flash?
Flash, that's right. He did those terrific issues of Flash. He does really dynamic stuff, interesting character work. There's a lot of energy and action in his pages, as we saw with the Flash. And then Jordi Belair is, you know, one of the best colorists. And this is a really good looking book. You know, right now in DC, we're dealing with all this prelude to Year of the Villain. So in every issue, Lex Luthor shows up to offer the bad guys a power up. And here, Batgirl is dealing with Killer Moth, who is, you know, a joke, but he's auditioning for Lex Luthor, so he's really upped his game. And in the last arc, Barbara went broke because her startup failed, and so now she's worried about running out of batarangs. She's worried about running out of supplies. It's kind of a dumb conceit when you think about Bruce Wayne would easily write her a check, but maybe she's not asking for it, so she's dealing with herself, and so she's got to remember to go pick up her batarangs after she throws them because she needs them. So it's kind of interesting, but the art was really terrific, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what this creative team can do, because it's a bunch of names I've never seen work together, and they're all pretty top flight.
Nice.
Now, when we read Lazarus Rising number 1, the new quarterly format for your previous favorite book. You didn't like it.
I don't remember.
You, and also, not written by, despite the script, it's not written by Garth Ennis, it's written by Greg Rucka.
I was not going to say anything, but I was like, wow.
I'll call out my own really tired mistakes. You didn't like it because you thought the pacing was weird. It felt like it was like 2.5 issues.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the format.
So what's interesting here is that Rucka, in his little piece in the back, says, "This is hard. Writing this way is hard. I haven't figured it out yet, so I apologize." So he basically takes ownership for the growing pains, because he says it's not just like writing a longer comic. It's a completely different pacing and things, and I haven't cracked it yet. He says he thinks he's getting better, and he's cracked it with issue 3, but we'll find out.
Listen, Conrad, I'm not bad at this. I can analyze the success of a comic really well.
I think one of the things we talked about last time was that perhaps the extra pages was allowing them to wallow a bit more, and not necessarily in the best possible way. And I think this also happens in this issue, in which there's basically like an 18-page fight scene.
Yeah, I mean, really, that's what I noticed.
It's an exciting fight scene, but I don't know if it needed to be 18 pages long.
Well, I had exactly that thought, and I thought, well, if it was a good sequence, and no one ever gets to do it, but if you have a story as big as this that is so expansive in this world, then you don't have time for that.
And especially it's like coming out 4 times a year, and you got to remember a lot.
Yeah, and so that felt. I mean, I was gonna say it was great, but. You know, unless you can do 150 pages, then there's no time for that.
And we're not just saying this because it heavily involves Rebar, including one guy getting swung around while attached to Rebar.
There's a lot of...
Not cool. But I did like it.
Totally.
And the other criticism we had last time, which happened again, was that there's this new character, Sergeant Ocampo, who is like the training officer, and she looks exactly like Lazarus.
That got me again.
It got me again. Because there's one sequence where on page 31, if you got the PDF, which only Josh and I have, where Lazarus comes back to get repaired. And then you turn the page and it's Sergeant Ocampo wearing, not only having the same coloring and facial structure and the same haircut, but wearing the same black tank top and white and black pants. And so the only reason you know it's her is because she's got tattoos on her shoulders, which I didn't notice at first. So I was like, wait a minute. How did she get back to the base? And I had to realize, it's not her, but it looks exactly like her down in the outfit.
Is that that?
That's a real big problem. I can't believe it.
That must be on purpose. There must be some reason for that, because these people are too good.
It's strange. You'd think they'd notice, hey, when you turn the page, you've got this character who looks exactly like the main character wearing the same clothes.
Well, no, I was like, well, okay, I guess she's all better. That's not, oh, no, she's, is there a time jump? Is there, I don't know. You're right. It's a problem. Now, from a technical standpoint, from a sort of, with taking all these other things out of it, reading that fight scene was excellent. Like, it was really well done. The craft of it was great. But if I'm the editor, I'm like, maybe don't do this, because the fact is, like, you're giving just as much work to the artist to have to do, the writer gets to sort of take a flyer on it, in a way.
Now, if this is just coming out in issues, that's basically one entire issue.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's as big of a problem, because maybe there's more issues coming out throughout the year, but I don't remember however many issues Lazarus ever put out.
I mean, it wasn't, I think 12 would have been unusual.
So I don't know. I mean, it's a somewhat very important fight scene, but it need to be all one entire issue is like, maybe it could have been 3/4 of an issue.
You've got this other guy, I forget his name, but the guy who looks like a Gorgon coming out, could be another issue fight.
The big cliffhanger is the Russian Lazarus who showed up at the end. He's the one that fucked everybody up that one time.
Right.
And that really, really terrific issue, which I remember now that I think about it. But yeah, so that it's tough. It's really tough when you got a story of this depth that only comes out four times a year. First of all, to remember all the intricacies of it. I mean, he gives you a little recap page, but it's not enough for a book like this because there's just so much going on. It's tough. This was once one of our top 5 books. I don't know where to put it right now.
I'm glad that it exists. I'm glad that we get Michael Lark. It does feel a little like, they're trying to keep something alive, and by changing it, they changed it.
Right.
You know, there's the old guard too.
Would have been better to go to trades. I realize that's even more economically unsound, but like, mm-hmm. at least then you could have had a full 6-issue arc happen and plot that out as opposed to, you know, whatever's happening here.
Yeah. You know, it's better to have it than not, but it's a change. Maybe it's a change that we need to get used to and they need to get used to, and they'll get back on schedule. But, you know, think about it, 4 times a year, it's going to take a long time before you feel any resolutions for this.
Yeah. The Flash 75 is the final issue of the year one story, and I just wanted to mention it because it starts out, the thing at the end of the last issue was the Flash shows up in costume, and it's a traditional Flash costume. And he starts off that issue this way, but he has to really sort of imbue himself with the Speed Force, so he has to really activate it, and that causes the dumbass lines on his suit. I don't know why that would happen.
The Speed Force has a design component to it. Actually, it's the design force.
Well, that would make sense. I'm sure.
I was totally down with this. By the way, this is another example of you. I'm like, I gotta cut some titles. I can't read anything. Like, you're gonna read that. You're doing it with Valkyrie. You're doing it like I'm trying to get away, and you're the one. No, you should cut some titles. You never let me. And so I read this whole thing, and I was great with it. And then there was one bit where they said the Still Force, and I was like, just move on. Just move on. Yeah. Just don't even pay attention to it. Keep going.
And the guy had a really dumb name too. What was it? It was something dumb.
Yeah,
I don't remember what it was. I feel the same way. I'm like, no, just you moved on really successfully, and now we're fucked. And then they, you know, the dumb Wally Wallace thing. He's like, here's my nephews, Wally and Wallace.
Yeah,
don't ask questions. Like, I feel like that's the creative team just being like, we don't, it's not our fault, man.
Listen, I'm just doing my job here.
Yeah, I'm doing what I'm told. I realize this is also dumb. there's also one really funny part, page 17, where, you know, we're getting sort of a recap of Barry's life, and we see his dad in jail, but the bars are so far apart that he could just slip out very easily.
I mean, there's some bits where Howard Porter gets pretty Howard Porter-y here.
The part we see the kids, there's everyone's too short. Everyone's very compressed. Yes. Yeah, that was a bad page.
Yeah, page 6. Like, there's two guys standing in a crowd, and there's like everyone's just a little squat.
And page 19 is bad. Like, look, we have to be fair. He's usually really great, but you know sometimes not. And page 19, that's not good. It's not a good page.
No, it isn't. That's really bad. Yeah, it's Barry the Hobbit.
Oh yeah, here it is. Steadfast, the new avatar of the Steel Force. I was like, oh god,
yeah,
that's horrible.
Yeah,
but
overall, I'll take it over. Really, I will take that over a lot less stylized artists. You know,
sure, for
like
sure.
Like it's got a feeling, so that's cool.
So now you didn't read A Walk Through Hell.
This is just an example of, you know, like it's over on a publisher that tends to not be on my radar so much, and that's on me.
Sure.
Also, because it's a horror book, right?
You know, Aftershock.
That's less attractive to me now. I know when I can say, like, and I can tell you, Garth Ennis is my favorite writer in comics for sure, but I don't like everything he's ever done.
Sure.
You've really enjoyed this, though.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Okay. Well, yeah, you haven't been talking about it.
I've been very confused. I've talked about a handful of the issues. I don't, this is the final issue, by the way. Garth Ennis, Goran Suzuka. I don't even know what this was really about or what the story was, what the point of the story was. So basically, the first issue was pretty terrific. And I think you read the first issue. It was when it opened up with there's something happening in a warehouse. The cops have gone in, but the SWAT team that went in came out, and they all committed, well, sort of a suicide. They all shot each other in the head.
Right.
And so then these two FBI agents go in, and they basically get stuck in this sort of horrific labyrinth inside this warehouse, and this whole 12 issues has been an exploration of these characters in the warehouse as we come to sort of understand that the serial killer that they were investigating prior to this incident is really the devil, or maybe he's God. This issue is all about Garth Ennis's ongoing exploration of his problems with Catholicism and organized religion in general. Mm. And like this issue really, there's some terrific sequences and conversations. I sent just So, you know, I sent Josh some screen caps. I was like, oh my God, look at this. Look at this page. You know, there's some really sharp analyzing of
social commentary.
Religion. And in this conversation between the FBI agent and this possible demon person, and the question becomes, oh, am I the devil or am I God? Because, you know, God's done some bad things. Maybe God was a devil all along. And so there's a lot of that kind of conversation. And this whole issue is basically just one long conversation between these two characters, and it's really good. So it went out kind of a bang, even though after it was all over, I was like, I don't really know what the point of all this was.
Well, I mean, and then the context is he's been wrestling with these issues his whole career, which makes right. sense because he's from Northern Ireland. If you know anything about that, there's right. some things to contend with there. And I like that. I like that, you know, you've got, you know, on one side, you've got your Neil Gaiman, who's you know, continuing theme is, you know, gods who walk among us. And then, you know, Garth Ennis is about the relative good or evil of a, you know, a supreme deity. And it's interesting. It's a life's work. I don't, like I said, don't love everything he does, but you know that he's great.
And I will say this for the final bit of social commentary of this book is that the FBI agent, it's hard to say what actually has happened and what's real, and what's not real in this book. That's part of the problem. But like she leaves the warehouse, she's at a diner, a roadside diner in the desert, and spends one, two, three pages watching the news.
Jesus.
And it's basically just news taken from today, you know, Trump, immigration stuff, LGBT rights, police shootings. One of the guys at the diner says something very horrible about people protesting police shootings. And then she just goes back into the warehouse. It's better in there with the demons than it is out with us. So I feel like Garth is in a dark place right now.
I mean, who isn't?
So it was a weird book. I'm glad I read it all the way through, if only to read this issue. But I mean, I could, if you put a gun to my head, much like all the characters do at some point in this book, I don't know that I could tell you what it was really about.
Maybe he
and could. I just could be stupid too. That's always a possibility.
And maybe he's working through something, and sort of this is what came out organically.
Possibly. So those are the books we're going to talk about. There's a lot of books this week, but it's not an indefinite show. Patron pick. As we mentioned earlier, the patron pick was a tie. It was a tie between History of the Marvel Universe and House of X number one. House of X number one won the coin toss, so here we are. This is the much-heralded return of Jonathan Hickman to the Marvel stable, as he writes in a six-issue miniseries, House of X, that kicks off, I think, six new X-Men books that he is involved with somehow or another. With art by Pepe Larraz, who I think is one of the best new Marvel artists to come around in a while. And I've always been a big Hickman fan, although I haven't loved everything he's done. I've been overall a big Hickman fan. Josh has been the dark opposite to my experience with Hickman. You've liked some things, but disliked most things.
I'm the exception.
Right.
You know, I think.
So what did you think of this then?
I liked it a lot. I don't know, you know, it's X-Men, and I tend to not, and it's deep X-Men, really. It's super imaginative. I liked that it looked like a regular comic book, you know, as opposed to being completely chock full of his graphic design stuff, which is totally, you know, his move. And there was some of that in there. At one point, like my wife sort of walked by me and she's like, "You done reading?" And I was like, "No." And she's like, "That doesn't look like a comic book." And I was like, "No, it doesn't." Because that was on one of his, you know, sort of design informational pages.
Right.
I like the aesthetic of what he does a lot. I think that there's an element of fun that does not exist there for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is very different than how it used to be, I think. And so as we go through this, he's reimagined this world, how it is. I don't know why Professor Xavier looks like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading the X-Men books sort of off and on, and I think I've seen that character before, but I don't remember how or why. But to me, that is part of the fun of it. I mean, it's kind of their job. It's kind of their job to explain it, because most people reading this issue probably haven't been reading all the X-Men books. That's the entire point of this big launch with the big name creators, to get more people on the book. So he's going to have to explain this. I'm sure he will. that there's a new, again, there's a new mutant country called Krakoa from the mutant island. They've created a world with various portals throughout the world, and only mutants are allowed. And in this issue, a bunch of ambassadors from other countries come to confront the X-Men about it, while also there's the thing with that whole group of that's like made up of X people from AIM and SHIELD and SWORD and
there's a lot.
A lot of acronyms I've not heard of.
And I think it's enjoyable. I think the level of craft is very high. I think, you know, but is it necessarily what I want from it? It's the same thing as the other stuff. Like, I feel like I feel like I know the creator's personality too well, where I'm like, I want to see it stretch out of this, but it's always this same sort of like deeply plotted, very calm, like, watch how cool this is. You're not even ready for it. You know, like, there's an element of whimsy that is not there at all, I think.
Well, you know what I enjoyed, and my favorite sequence, I thought had some whimsy to it, was the fight between the Fantastic Four and Sabretooth and Mystique. Mm-hmm. And then Cyclops shows up, and traditionally speaking, that he's the escalation piece, right? He shows up and things get worse. So the Fantastic Four have captured Sabretooth in one of Sue's, you know, invisible boxes. Mystique got away through the portal. And they're like, yeah, no, Cyclops wants him back because, you know, he's a mutant, sort of like, you know, authority over mutants. And they're like, no, he committed a crime. We're keeping him, even though they're not police. and so traditionally, they're like, this situation would lead to conflict. You know, there's a point where a while ago, you would have turned the page and Cyclops would have blasted Reed with his, you know, force blast. Mm-hmm. Instead, he goes, yeah, okay, you keep him. We'll figure it out. So that was a new twist on the whole Cyclops relationship. Which was good.
That reminds me, actually, of one of the thoughts that I had while I was reading, is that I don't know who Cyclops is anymore. I know that there was like a big change. And
no one knows. Yeah.
Basically, everyone was radicalized. He was radicalized, but also he's still, what I liked about that scene was that, like, he's still like recognizing, you know, yeah, we were on the same team for a long time but things have changed now. I actually think it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect logical sense to look at the mutants and recognize why they have become this militant and this radicalized. Why at the end, you know, shit, Magneto was right. You know, we're future Charles, not them. It's all right. It makes sense. I also find it incredibly disheartening and not fun. Like, it works out, but, like, you know, I want all the good guys to be on the same team, I guess. You know, like, I want those old relationships to matter. I want you to be able to overcome this without saying, you know, separate and not equal is really what's going on here. You know, Magneto, by having him front and center, is saying, you know, like, well, we are your masters now. And again, it all makes sense, but it's a bummer.
Yeah, and I mean, the only thing I can really dig, I really like this issue quite a bit. The only thing I can really, and this was up there for also in the Pick a Week discussion, but the only negative thing I can think of is that it did feel like I've read this before in terms of, as I said at the top of the review, they created their own sanctuary. They claim, you know, amnesty, and then there's conflict. You know, because the rest of the government's like, no, you don't get to just rule yourselves. I feel like I've read that story four or five times in the last 10 years, and so
I think I've read about it, but I haven't read it.
Right, and I'm trusting Hickman to do something different with it, because right now the setup feels very similar.
Yeah, so far it's just his style that's different.
Comics. Comics retread themselves all the time, but I also haven't read much different in between those stories. It feels like it's just different. Every time a new writer comes on, it's the same thing. It's, you know, we have a moon base, or we have a secret dimensional base that no one else can get to. You know, it seems like that's what keeps happening. And so we'll see what Hickman, because I'm in for this mini. I'm obviously not going to be in for the whole run of X-Men books, but I'll be in for a few of them. So I'm curious to see what they do here that's different.
At the end, in the sort of schedule, it was like two series that are actually one series. And I'm reading the schedule, like, so you have to read this weekly now? Is that what's going on here? And I kind of don't want that.
The Marvel way.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I really don't like that approach.
I don't either.
I like it occasionally, you know, for...
It's for a special thing, but
a month-long story where you're going 8 issues or something like
you'd
that.
You'd be hard pressed to say that this is not hurting the market. This strategy,
it's like everything. It's like a short-term goal, a short-term gain, and not.
They're making their quarter, but they're going to kill their future.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got on this thing, the reading order. 3 of the issues are highlighted in red, and that's a clue of some kind.
Sure.
This is all like, let's make this all a mystery. Just tell me a story is all I want. Like, I don't want, there's a style to it I just don't like. And it's good. Like, it's absolutely good. I saw a friend of mine say something like, he's working at a level that's completely different than everybody else. And I was like, he absolutely is. Like, right. Totally. There's, you know, and I don't even want to say he's getting better. Hickman's always been this good.
Yes.
But also, like, if I had to go back and read, you know, I don't want to read his Fantastic Four stories. I want to read fun Fantastic Four stories. Really, you know?
All right, that was a patron pick. Let's do ratings on the patron pick. Ratings out of 5. I'm going to give it a 4.5. I really liked it.
I'm actually going to give it the same thing.
Wow.
On an objective level, I can't deny that.
So are you sticking with it? I am, obviously.
Yeah. For a time, I'm sure I know what'll happen, but
yeah. Well, that's the patron pick.
Cool, we did that. Hey, how does one get to vote on that patron pick? Well, I'll answer my own question. You would go over to patreon.com/ifanboy, and that is where you can directly support this show that you are listening to and very likely have been listening to a really long time in a really sort of simple yet effective way. We depend on this support to keep doing the show at the level that we're doing it. When I keep reading more and more books, even though I say I don't have time to read more books, but I...
You made me read Skyward. There's other books I'm reading because of you.
I know.
It's a give and take scenario.
I know. I'm not blaming you for that. A little bit.
A little bit.
But no, seriously, you know, it is a really helpful thing. And if you've been thinking about it, you're on the fence, whether this is worth it. I'm here to tell you, as the person who is making this along with my partner here, it's a really big deal. And everybody who does, we are eternally grateful to. So thank you for that. The next stretch goal, if we get there, is, of course, the non-comics media podcast and all of the remaining video shows that we have done uploaded to our YouTube channel. Some of them are very old. I was reminded by this in my Tom King Talksplode, where he's like, I went back and I watched a bunch of old video shows, and I was like, oh no, don't do that. But actually, like, I am proud of them. I'm proud of that as a thing that we did, and I think that record should definitely exist, even if I don't ever want to look at it. You can also go to ifanboy.threadless.com, where you can buy t-shirts, sweatshirts, tank tops, different kinds of t-shirts, phone cases, mugs, bath mats, shower curtains, all of those kinds of things. With some of our designs on them. You can also, if you don't want to deal with any of that, and you just say, you know what, can I give you a little cash? Can I help keep this going? Can I throw something in the tip jar? That is at ifanboy.com/support, where you'll find a direct link to PayPal. You will also find ifanboy.com/Amazon, which will put it together here. Take you to Amazon. You can find links to buy our Booksplode books. We always have a link to the Pick of the Week book in that page on our website as well. You know, thank you. Thank you all so much for what you do to help us keep going with this. We love it. And you make that possible.
While you were talking, I was looking through my my series page on my iPad. And we were talking about Busick earlier. Remember that Batman book you never finished?
Did you not finish that?
No. 3 issues came out. Creature of the Night.
If there's any knock against him is that sometimes he doesn't get his scripts in. And for a long time, that was, you know, health issues. And who knows, when you get older, those don't get any easier. That was a good series. I really liked that.
It was a great series. John Paul Leonhardt.
Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe he's not the issue there.
So let's talk about patron powers. As Josh said, everyone at patreon.com/fanboy can vote to add a book to the rundown of the patron pick. Everyone gets to watch the Hangouts, which we did last week. Everyone gets to hang out in the patron page and the Facebook group and talk about and make fun of us. But only those who give the $5 higher level get a patron power live on the show, like these lucky 4 patrons. By the way, I thought we were getting close, Josh, but then we updated the spreadsheet and there's a lot more new patrons.
Well, I mean, that's what we're asking for when we say sign up for the Patreon.
Right. So we're not even close.
Listen, I don't want to not do this, and I don't think anybody listening wants to not do this, and that's a consideration that they should make.
Absolutely.
So, Joe Jordan. Anybody, especially parents, could call Joe Jordan up and say, "What is the amount of appropriate screen time for real?" And he would tell you.
Per kid or just in general?
Yeah, per kid. He could give you, or person. And anybody, you know, like, am I doing this too much? Am I looking? Am I okay? Is it not? Is my kid all right? Joe Jordan has that answer. Something that no scientist or you know, no psychologist, no thinker really knows anything about.
They're all just making it up.
1,000%. Joe can be like, no, this is okay. You might want to limit it in this way. He'll tell you exactly what the deal is. You know, it's a valuable service.
That is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Is he out of the goodness of his heart, or did he start like a business?
I mean, it's up to him. The fact is that he's able to tell you. He knows.
Mm.
Like, he can analyze the situation in a way. Like, you know, like, what's his name from the Inhumans?
Right.
Can tell you what the structural weakness in anything is.
I see.
That's Joe's thing.
I just accidentally closed the script. Here it is.
Kenneth Luther. Go ahead.
Kenneth Luther, he can blink his eyes and change the TV channels. Now, here's the twist. He doesn't change his own TV channel. He changes the TV channel of one Judith McGillicuddy of Topeka, Kansas.
Oh,
84 geez. Years old, sweet old grandmother. When Kenneth blinks, her TV channel changes.
That's like the old Stephen Wright joke.
Is it?
Yeah, the joke was like, I have a light switch in my apartment. I have no idea what it does. I flip it off and on all the time and nothing happens. Then a couple of months ago, I got a letter from a lady in Germany that said, cut it out.
That's pretty funny. I had never heard that joke.
Yeah.
But there you go. That's a good joke.
I know a lot of those jokes. I'm not good at remembering jokes, but I remember Stephen Wright jokes.
How the lady knows him.
That's the joke.
That's what makes it funny. So anyway, Kenneth has a very similar power in that one.
All right.
I thought out of the plane, like, could not sleep. I don't know why. I was looking at other people's TVs. I don't think I could change them.
And what was her name?
Judith McGillicuddy.
Yeah.
Was that Topeka, Kansas? 84 yeah. years old, sweet grandmother, bakes apple pies.
You went through her shit when she went to the bathroom? Yeah. Judith it is. Just to give it a sense of verisimilitude.
Sure.
Edward knows which way not to go to avoid traffic. Doesn't need Waze.
He's an optimized Google Maps.
Yeah, yeah, he does. He doesn't. And it's much. Have you ever been in the car and Google says go this way, and it takes you into God knows where?
Yeah, no, I've stopped using Waze and all those things because it keeps trying to get me. In LA, it's a dangerous scenario.
Yes,
trying to get me to turn left on a boulevard that does not have a left hand turn.
Right, right, right.
Like, you want me to turn left on Melrose?
From this random
side street?
In my world, you're right. I've done that. It doesn't work in Boston. It doesn't work in Los Angeles. It doesn't work in New York City. Where I live, it is helpful in that way.
I'm sure, yeah, yeah.
You know, in Boston, the problem is the streets are all so weird and close together that it never catches up.
We don't even have time to get into the problem with Boston streets.
We don't, but the fact is Edward doesn't need any of that. Now,
right.
He doesn't necessarily know the way. He's not the GPS. But he is the traffic and rerouting component.
So if you tell him where you're going, he knows how to get there.
Right. So, like, you know, he looks and he says, oh, I got to take Route 93, and then we're going to get off at exit 12, and then we're going to take a left. He'll get to the part where you have to take a left and be like, we can't go this way. It's like a spider sense.
Right.
And he'll go most optimum route to get there. And at that point, it's just instinct taking over.
The patron known only as Drunk Viking.
Rawr.
Which seems to be just Viking. Whenever, and I thought of this before, I thought, who knew?
Are you saying that the teetotaling Viking is is really more of the outlier?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's the qualifying name. Drunk Viking, whenever he or she throws a fishing line into the water, immediately catches a fish.
Wow. Have you ever been fishing?
Yes.
Do you like fishing?
I mean, I haven't been since I was a kid.
Uh-huh. I took my son fishing. Well, I took my son to my mom's, which is up in Maine on a stream, and they went fishing. And I don't like fishing.
I can't imagine you would.
No, like it
requires
I don't
a level of patience and stillness that you're not down with.
But there's no reward for it. Like the reward fish. Is catching a fish. Like I feel bad for the fish. I don't want to touch the fish. I feel like I've done something rude. My 9-year-old loves it, which surprised the heck out of me. I took him like 2 weeks ago. Kid wouldn't stop catching fish.
Does he like to eat fish?
No. Also, you can't eat the fish where my mom lives because the water's too cold. Mm-hmm. It makes them mealy. I mean, you can, but it's gross. He caught six. He caught six fish in the course of an hour and a half. And what I was super concerned about was he was going to stand out there, not catch anything, and get frustrated. Couldn't stop. The 5-year-old caught two. I didn't catch any.
Is your 9-year-old named Drunk Viking?
Yes, it is.
Is he the patron named Drunk Viking?
I'm just saying, if Drunk Viking is part of the Viking village, then he's the most valuable guy there because you could give him fish, but it's way more valuable that a guy knows how to fish.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can go and get a really super groovy patron power, just like those we just said.
Sure enough. I think, given the time that we're on, we should save mm-hmm. these for later.
I would just say this. The first one's really fast.
All right, do it.
Tom writes and says, I've pondered this question ever since the Mr. Oz reveal. I understand that in the latest incarnation of Superman, Jor-El somehow survived Krypton's demise and is now trying to bond with his son, Kal-El. Well, I wish them all the best. Isn't this the wrong Superman? I thought the new Superman disintegrated to be replaced by Family Man Superman, John, and older Lois Lane. At least Superman and Batman now have something else in common besides mom's name Martha, undead dads from other universes.
I know the answer to this one.
We have a t-shirt.
Yes, it is.
We got a t-shirt for you, Tom. Answers all your questions.
Uh-huh.
First of all, we don't know for sure this is Jor-El. That the big truth is coming in the next issue, right? That was what the cliffhanger was.
Yeah. I guess. I don't remember.
I mean, it could be him. It'll be horrible if they actually go through with it. But nothing makes sense, nothing matters. I don't know. Sure. I mean, yes, technically speaking, the new 50 Superman disintegrated is replaced by the Superman that came through the dimensional portal from that stupid miniseries I didn't even read. From another Earth, brought mm-hmm. Lois with him. Brought his kid with them. So technically speaking, these are different. Yes, I have read nothing that would say otherwise. This is a different Superman than. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Let it go.
What are you going to do?
That way lies madness.
Buy a t-shirt. I wore my t-shirt the other day, and I kept looking at it in the mirror and going, yes, t-shirt, you are correct. We really didn't create the t-shirt for this age.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's infinitely applicable.
contact@ifanboy.com is where you can write in like Tom and like other people whose emails are in the script but not getting on the show to get on the show.
You know, now that we talked about how we choose the music, I'm really like self-obsessed with how I'm going to do it this week because I feel like
you got to go completely off the grain.
I know. Out now is the Booksplode, Planetary Book 2. What music did you choose for that?
Dirty World by the Traveling Wilburys.
Why?
Because world. The whole point of the book is that the world is dirty and fucked up and they need to keep it that way.
Cool. That's a good choice. You can find out, we did Booksplode, we did the Planetary Part 1 of the two new volumes that have been released in the last year or so. We finished it up, we did the second one, talked a little more.
We didn't even realize we did it almost exactly a year apart.
Yeah, I noticed. That's cool.
We did it, and then I looked it up, and I was like, holy shit, that was June 19th, and it was like June 20th or something that we did it. It was crazy. Yeah. But that's right behind this show in the feed.
That's available.
Check that out. Coming later in this month, not this month, what month is it? Coming in late August will be the Batman Hush animated Brain Trust review with Paul Montgomery, Ryan Haupt, and I discussing the latest Batman DC Universe animated film based on the acclaimed Jeff Loeb, Jim Lee miniseries Batman Hush. Not my favorite story, so we'll see how that goes. That's our next special edition show coming out.
Absolutely. You can head over to ifanboy.com. You can find all of our podcasts that we just talked about. You know, do we number the Booksplodes? I don't know, but there's a lot of them.
We did, yes. I think there's 32 or 33.
And I think I'm on 80 Talksplodes. There's a lot of special edition shows. This is just in addition to our sort of regular. You know, we've had people go back through all the Pick of the Weeks before, but I don't know if we've had anybody go back through all the special editions.
Well, there's over 1,000 shows total, audio-wise.
Okay. There seems to be a lot of people out there with a lot of time.
32 Booksplodes, yes.
Wow.
And 85 Talksplodes.
Wow, cool. You can find out what the Pick of the Week is before the show comes out, liking facebook.com/ifanboy or at ifanboy on Twitter, and also over on Instagram there is ifanboy comics, at ifanboy comics there, where Connor really does the Best of the Week in panels, and the other stuff we find that we think might be of interest to you, as well as you can see what the Pick of the Week is before it comes up. You can follow us individually on Instagram and on Instagram right now. Neither of us are using Twitter at the moment. J.A. Flanagan and C.S. Kilpatrick for that.
Yeah, so if you send us a Twitter message, at the moment for Josh, it's going into the ether. For me, it's always going into the ether. So just keep that in mind. You know, you can always reach us at contact@fanboy.com.
That's true.
If you like the show, while it's still around, leave us a review on iTunes or a star rating. That would be something that would be really helpful. If you can't buy a shirt or donate or become a patron or tell your friends or your mom about us, if you just, you know, leave a quick star rating, just a quick click.
Yeah.
It really helps people find podcasts. The more ratings for any show you listen to, the better. Do that for any show you listen to. I just listened to Mark Maron episode I missed with Stephen Dorff, and it was terrific. And I've already left Mark Maron review star rating, so I can't do that again. But if I hadn't, I would have done it after listening to that because it was a good interview.
Fair enough.
So tell your friends, tell your mom, leave a star rating. That helps iFanboy tremendously. We do thank everyone who's done that over the last 14 years. Ugh. 14 years?
I guess. Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah,
I mean, 14 in November.
Yeah. 13 and a half years?
Yeah. More, but yeah.
13 years is the length of time we did the website as a full website.
Oh, yeah?
So we're going to pass, in December, we will pass the time we did the website on the podcast.
Well, that's a thing.
Put that in your head and mix it around.
There's too much in there. That's not a good idea.
That is fucked.
That should be the next iTunes review. Apple Podcasts. Let's just start calling it that. It's going to be a separate app, same thing. It's fine. All that stuff's not going anywhere.
So help us spread the love. Thank you for listening. I'm going to sleep now. My name is Connor.
Oh, enjoy yourself with that
sleep. I'm actually not going to sleep for another probably 10 hours. That's going to be fun.
Do you know what? I know that we're over and this is what we always do. You know in fall or Dodge in Hell at the beginning where Dodge says he has to take an afternoon nap every day?
Yeah.
And even if it's only as short as just falling asleep briefly, shutting his brain off and rebooting.
Yeah.
I do that.
Have you noticed yourself twitching now and now freaking out about it?
No.
Because there's a whole part in the book where he talks about what the twitch is in the brain.
Uh-huh.
And it's your brain sort of rebooting. And so now, like, because I do that sometimes. My leg or my arm will twitch as I'm falling asleep. And now that I've read that book, it wakes me up. Like, I think about it.
Huh. No, I think I forgot that part, but like that just solidified that I took that fiction book and I was like, that makes sense. But it's probably something behind
about.
It.
You don't know what's real or not in that book.
It's true.
Oh, Neal Stephenson.
All right, folks. Thank you.
Bye.
Get some rest.